bow. On his fourth try, he finally got the match head to ignite, and was so surprised he nearly dropped the small flame onto Vince's carpet. He was able to keep his hold, though, and slowly moved the burning match so it was directly between himself and Vince. Vince's eyes were locked on the flame, focusing on it with all of his concentration. Ever so gently, Vince raised his hand and opened it so that his palm was level with the match. For a few seconds, nothing happened. Then, the flame began to lean toward Vince's palm. A moment later, there was a small burst of heat, and Nick was pinching only a tiny piece of ash between his fingers.
"Whoa!" Nick exclaimed. "What did you do?"
"I absorbed the energy of the flame," Vince explained. "That's my ability. I can absorb energy and store it for later."
"What do you mean, for later?"
Nick said, already pulling another match from the book. In response, Vince held up the index finger on his right hand. A small flame appeared at the tip of his finger, a flame about the same size and intensity as the one he had just vanquished. It burned for almost 10 seconds, then vanished just as quickly as it had appeared. "I can use the energy I absorb any time I want," Vince continued, once his finger was out. "I can use it slowly, like I did just now, or release it in controlled bursts. In this case, it would have made a tiny fireball. I don't have the ability to extend or increase it, though. However much energy I have absorbed is what I have to work with."
"Awesome," Nick said, nodding his head. "Now do this one."
Vince sighed, but he couldn't deny this was good practice, so he accommodated his dorm mate's demands for entertainment and absorbed the rest of the matches one by one.
"I have another question for you," Nick said, as Vince snuffed out the final match from the book.
"Shoot," Vince replied. His mind had wandered off near the end of their practice session, focusing instead on how the aching weariness he had been fending off seemed to be decreasing a bit in his absorbing hand. He wondered if using a part of his body as an absorption point had pain-fighting properties.
"I get that you absorb the flame as it exists, but why is it every time you use your power I wind up holding nothing but a fleck of ash? Does stealing the energy destroy the matchstick?"
Nick was poking at the small piece of ash Vince's last absorption had left on his fingernail.
"Yes and no," Vince said, turning his attention back to his dorm mate. "Remember when I said I was still getting the hang of some stuff? Well, that's what I meant. See, I don't just absorb the existing energy. I absorb the potential energy as well. At least I do if I don't sever the connection."
"Yeah, I've really got no idea what you're talking about," Nick said, flicking off the piece of ash and checking the matchbook to see if he had missed any.
"Okay, how to explain this? Look, let's pretend that you have another match and you light it, okay?"
Vince said.
"Sure, why not?" Nick agreed.
"Now, if you leave the match be, the fire will eventually consume all of the wood," Vince said. "However, if you were to lick your fingers and put it out halfway through, then you would still have some of the matchstick left. With me so far?"
"Mostly,"
Nick said. "Good," Vince said, choosing to plow ahead and hope for the best. "Well, obviously, the match that is allowed to burn all the way down produces more fire and therefore more energy. See, that's why the match disintegrates in your hand. When I steal the energy of the flame, I don't just take all the energy that's there, I also take all of the energy that has the potential to be there."
"I don't suppose you could break that down a little easier, could you?"
Nick asked, pulling out his dice and fiddling with them. Vince took a deep breath and tried to hold his patience. This could be a confusing concept if someone wasn't used to it. Vince needed to keep that in the front of his mind.
"Think of it like this," Vince tried again. "There is only ash in your hand because
in the fraction of a second where I begin drawing on the energy of the match, the whole thing burns up in a flash and is taken into my body. That makes sense?
Actually, yeah, Nick said. But if it burns all at once, then why aren't my fingers singed? I mean, if I'm holding it and it burns, it should hurt.
You're not totally wrong, Vince said. Normally that would still burn you. But heat is a form of energy, and I'm taking everything the match has to give. So while it might flash burn in your fingers, all of the heat flows into me.
Dude, Nick said. I get it, but your power is fucking complicated.
This from the guy whose ability works on quantum probabilities, Vince pointed out.
I don't know what you're talking about, Nick said. I just control luck. Nothing complicated about that.
Right, Vince said sarcastically. Nothing complicated at all. 6. Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport sat at a small cafe in Paris, sipping their respective coffees. They had been saddled with a busy day so far. However, they were provided with a nice gap at lunchtime, so Mr. Transport had suggested they adjourn to one of their favorite dining establishments. Mr. Numbers had concurred, and they had left the sweltering plains of Africa for a more tranquil and enjoyable environment in which to dine. As was their custom, they were reviewing the particulars of their next assignment before departing. Mr. Transport had been somewhat surprised to see that it was classified as long-term. Those assignments were quite rare, given his and Mr. Numbers' capabilities for handling things in a prompt and efficient manner. The deeper he read into the dossier, though, the more concerned Mr. Transport grew.
Mr. Numbers, Mr. Transport ventured tentatively.
Yes, Mr. Transport?
Mr. Numbers replied, without looking up from his own copy of the assignment file.
Do you feel that perhaps there was a misfile, and we were given someone else's assignment?
Mr. Transport asked, trying desperately to keep any hope out of his voice. It was very bad for one's job and health to be heard questioning the wisdom of the company they worked for.
The possibility crossed my mind, Mr. Numbers admitted. However, if you read on, you will see certain accommodations at the target's place of employment have been made specifically for us. It even references us by name several times.
Mr. Transport flipped a few pages ahead, and sure enough, Mr. Numbers had been correct.
Very well, Mr. Transport said carefully. Just wanted to be certain we were deployed to the right area.
Quite understandable, Mr. Numbers agreed. It would be irresponsible of us as agents to allow time and resources to be wasted on a clerical error. Since that is not the case, though, it seems we have a few more hours until we begin our new assignment.
That it does. Perhaps we should use that time to pack and prepare, so we are properly equipped for the full term of the assignment, Mr. Transport suggested.
Excellent idea, said Mr. Numbers. Would you mind depositing me first, then swinging back by in an hour or so to pick me up?
Not at all, assured Mr. Transport.
He reached into his wallet and pulled out a few bills. Mr. Transport kept a variety of currency for almost every country in the world available at his apartment. It was much faster than trying to haggle or work out an exchange rate every time. Plus, it allowed him and his partner to stay in the background, the area in which they were most comfortable. Mr. Transport set the money on the table, careful to tip generously. A moment later, he and Mr. Numbers were gone. Across the cafe, an elderly gentleman glanced at their table and noticed their absence. He nonchalantly folded his paper, set some money on his own table, and headed off to make a phone call.
The elderly gentleman did not tip nearly as well as Mr. Transport. Several thousand miles away, in the middle of the Arctic tundra, Mr. Transport and Mr. Numbers reappeared. Both began shivering almost immediately. "How long?" Mr. Transport asked, willing his teeth to keep from chattering.
3 minutes, 14 seconds until health problems begin to set in,"
Mr. Numbers replied automatically, as he felt the temperature around him, tested the speed of the wind, and added in the meager protection his black suit offered him.
"Watch is set for 3 minutes,"
Mr. Transport said, quickly fiddling with the high-priced device on his wrist. Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport were very careful when they wanted to talk openly. They always selected areas with no possible people to surround them, and abstract locales with ample background noise so that listening devices and GPS would be rendered ineffective. They never used the same place twice, and always kept their conversations under 5 minutes. Say what you will about Mr. Numbers, he was a very calculating man. No pun intended.
"Now then, what do you actually make of our new assignment? Are we being punished?"
"For what?" Mr. Numbers shot back. "Our success rate is 98%. We finish our missions in the fastest time of any team, and we have had no recorded insubordination in the history of our career."
"Then what would make them do this to us?"
Mr. Transport asked, allowing the uncertainty and fear he had kept hidden away since he saw the document flood into his voice.
"We mustn't assume the worst," said Mr. Numbers. "Many of the reasons they had for putting us on this job are actually quite sound. They expect me to see any problems coming before they reach a critical point, and you'll be necessary in the event we need to evacuate ourselves and any others involved."
"I don't imagine that's really all there is to it,"
Mr. Transport said flatly.
"Nor do I," said Mr. Numbers. "Unfortunately, with the data I have, I don't yet know what the ulterior motive of placing us in this position is. The only option we have is the same one we've always had. Do our jobs, stick to the books, and give me enough time to see what's happening behind the scenes."
"Do you think you'll be able to figure it out before we're stuck in whatever trap someone is planning?"
Mr. Transport asked.
"I always have. Of course, that doesn't mean I always will, but I don't really see any other options available to us, let alone any better ones,"
said Mr. Numbers.
"Agreed," said Mr. Transport.
A loud beeping began emanating from his wrist. Mr. Transport raised his watch and promptly turned it off. Without another word said, he and Mr. Numbers were gone from the sprawling white mounds of snow. They reappeared in the apartment Mr. Numbers was currently renting under the name Mr. Digit. Mr. Transport tipped his head to Mr. Numbers, then vanished to go pack his own bags. Mr. Numbers moved about his home, carefully controlling his movements so as not to show his body's relief at entering the heat by shivering from the residual cold still clinging to him. Instead, he packed up his clothes, which consisted predominantly of suits, gathered his very few personal effects, and then bagged up the remainder of his possessions, which were his toiletries. The room would need to be cleaned of all traces of him, but the company had a department for that. They would also take care of settling up the rent and making sure no one asked questions about Mr. Digit's sudden departure. Mr. Numbers took a moment to go to his window and pull back the thick, black curtain. Looking out, he sighed as his eyes took in the splendor of Rome. From his vantage point, he had an excellent view of the Colosseum. That was why he had chosen this apartment in the first place. Mr. Numbers was not the type to get caught up in sentimentality or nostalgia, but as he sat on his windowsill looking out, he had to admit that he was going to miss this view. He wished he could rent this place again once his assignment was over. However, that was against protocol. Once an agent had left a place, he could never return. Mr. Transport reappeared some time later, carrying a large brown tweed suitcase and a black duffel bag. As Mr. Transport walked toward the window, Mr. Numbers noticed a slight clinking sound coming from Mr. Transport's bag. Mr. Numbers bit back his desire to chastise Mr. Transport for bringing along alcohol. Given what the duo would soon be doing, there was a very strong possibility that Mr. Numbers would be seeking a nip of the hard stuff himself. "Ready?" Mr. Transport asked as he reached the window and joined Mr. Numbers.
"Of course,"
Mr. Numbers replied on cue, holding his own baggage firmly so it wouldn't be left behind. And then the room was empty. Only the slight echo of a voice filled with duty and the warm Roman sunlight left to fill it. 7. The silver-haired boy was fidgeting nervously. Alice noted that in the back of her mind, not particularly intrigued, but not ambivalent either. Every little detail added up to the sum of who a person was, and that was information worth having if she was going to be dealing with these people on a regular basis. The five students were assembled in the central common room, scattered among various seats. Mary was off to the side on her own, save for the stuffed bear she kept perched carefully in her lap. Alice had been tempted to ask why Mary had a stuffed animal, but the moment she had looked into those amber eyes, all desire had melted away in the face of the overwhelming certainty that talking to Mary was a bad idea. The boys were clustered together for the most part. Silver hair and sunglasses were lounging on the white couch, with the third boy in the chair to their side. He was a husky one, wearing a shirt that had strangely shaped dice on the front. Alice deduced within a few moments of hearing him speak that the boy was lacking the basic set of social skills. Then again, given who she was surrounded by, she could hardly say that he didn't fit in. Alice herself had taken a center position in the room, eager to appear eager for whatever authority figure Daddy had managed to wrangle into this babysitting job. Alice didn't expect whoever showed up to pose any real problem for her. After all, they would obviously know who her father was. But she still preferred to get her way through charm and cunning rather than threats and force. It was the way a proper lady got things done. As the clock struck 7, a bit too loudly, Alice noted with a grimace, a pair of men appeared in front of the group of students. They were dressed almost the same, save that the shorter of the two wore a tie, while the taller one did not. They wore black suits and white shirts, and both kept their dark hair trimmed. But while the short one had bright blue eyes, the larger one had muddy brown ones.
"Hello, students," said the shorter of the pair. "You may call me Mr. Numbers. My friend, Mr. Transport, and I are here to oversee and assist you in your academic endeavors. Our apartment is what lies behind the steel door in the kitchen. You will not be permitted access. However, an intercom is on the counter next to the pantry for emergency contact. Do we have any questions so far?"
Alice glanced around to test the temperature of the room. It seemed everyone but she and Mary were struck dumb by the appearance and promptness of the two men who had materialized in front of them. Alice suppressed the urge to scoff. Of course these poor dregs were surprised. Their only experience with people who had abilities was undoubtedly others like themselves. The sight of someone using precision teleportation would be truly alien to them. Alice wasn't quite sure why Mary wasn't more taken aback, but she readily chalked that up to just another aspect of the girl's strangeness.
"I take your silence to mean we are on the same page," Mr. Numbers continued. "Now, I want to be clear here. We've met most of you already when we were selecting people appropriate for the program you all participated in. We were nice and friendly then. We will continue to maintain that same level of friendliness during our tenure as your house administrators. However, please do not misinterpret my good nature as weakness. Mr. Transport and I are here to enforce the rules, and you will find we are both excellent at our jobs."
What rules are you talking about? The question came timidly from the silver-haired boy.
"A full copy will be issued before the week is over," Mr. Numbers replied. "I will touch briefly on the main three, though. First, you are to keep your identities secret at all times. This is a requirement of all those who participate in the Hero Certification Program, or HCP as we call it around here, and it is the duty of the administrators to observe who has broken it, intentionally or otherwise. That will be covered in more depth tomorrow during your first class. Secondly, there is to be no fighting with other supers or with regular humans outside the confines of the classroom."
"Wait," the silver-haired boy said again. "We're going to be fighting in class?"
"Of course," said Mr. Numbers. "You are training to be a hero. This means you must learn to fight against time, villains, and environmental conditions to save as many people as possible in any given scenario. Combat training will be a very important part of that."
"Don't worry," Mr. Transport broke in, speaking for the first time. "All fights are strictly monitored, and there is always someone with a healing power on hand to tend to both parties afterward."
"Mr. Transport is correct, though both he and you could stand to take a course in not interrupting," Mr. Numbers said, staring at the silver-haired boy. "Now then, the third rule is the most important for all of you. Your powers must stay within your control at all times. This is a rule specific to your situation, and certainly doesn't need explanation. Be aware that this is the primary reason Mr. Transport and myself were selected for this assignment. Should any of you lose control, we will act quickly and decisively to ensure the safety of those around, while simultaneously shutting down the problematic party."
"Wait, I thought we all had control of our abilities. That's why they let us enroll here."
This time, the speaker was the dark-haired boy wearing sunglasses. Alice noticed he spoke with a strange accent. Not quite northern, but not quite southern either. It seemed to be a hint of dialect from a region all its own.
"You all do have control of your abilities. Currently," said Mr. Numbers. "The procedure you underwent was experimental, though. Those who created and performed it are certain you will remain as supers and not drift back to your previous uncontrollable states. However, there are those who remain skeptical such a thing is possible, and the positioning of Mr. Transport and myself as overseers is a compromise to assure the safety of the regular student body."
"So what happens if someone loses control?"
Alice was shocked to realize this question had come from her own mouth. It wasn't as if she was a danger to anyone if she began floating around again, but she was concerned that the slip-ups of some of these cretins could affect her college career. At least, that's how she rationalized the sudden nagging fear that had formed in her stomach.
"Testing," Mr. Numbers replied simply.
"What Mr. Numbers means to say," Mr. Transport said, jumping in as he saw the looks of distress cross his charges' faces, "is that we will test and investigate the reason why control was lost. Maybe there was a psychological component, and it doesn't mean things failed. Maybe it's an individual case. Or maybe it just means the person will need another round of treatment. We don't anticipate anything going wrong with any of you, but if it does, we'll be there to find out exactly why it happened."
"I feel testing was an adequate answer,"
Mr. Numbers said. Now, do any of you have any questions about the rules I have set down so far?
There was silence, though this time it was less motivated by being dumbstruck at the dramatic entrance, and more motivated by the sudden fear they had all presumably acquired of someone losing control and screwing the deal for everyone.
Excellent, Mr. Numbers said. Then I will turn the floor over to Mr. Transport for some getting-to-know-our-dorm-mates activities.
With that, Mr. Numbers sat down in the chair directly opposite Alice. Alice, for her part, worked very hard to avoid his observant blue eyes and focus on the tall Mr. Transport. It seemed that everyone was following her lead on that account. Everyone, that is, except for Mary. Mary was staring directly into Mr. Numbers' big blue eyes, meeting his gaze with her own amber orbs. Since everyone was gazing intently at Mr. Transport, no one noticed the two looking at each other. If they did, though, certainly no one noticed, as Mary brought both of her hands up and began clapping them together softly, engaging in a very gentle, very silent session of applause.
8. Well then, Mr. Transport said, as the eyes of his charges fell curiously upon him. He was glad Mr. Numbers had allowed him to be the good cop in their interaction with the students, but he still felt a bit awkward dealing with a group of 18-year-olds. After all, Mr. Transport could scarcely remember a time when he'd shared the worries and concerns of an everyday teen. Of course, the reason Mr. Transport had trouble finding those memories was because they didn't exist. Being able to pop out of nearly every situation had a profound impact on diminishing the amount of things he'd had to worry about in his formative years. Why don't we do an exercise to get to know one another better? Mr. Transport waited for some sign of agreement or excitement from the students. Instead, he got back blank stares. So, after a moment, he elected to take that as the sign of their agreement.
Okay, Mr. Transport continued. Here is how it works. I want everyone to stand up, say their full name, what their ability is, where they are from, what their cover major is, and one interesting fact about themselves.
Again, Mr. Transport was met with silence. Having settled on choosing to perceive that in the positive, though, Mr. Transport was able to keep right on trucking.
I'll begin. My name is Mr. Transport. My power is teleportation of myself and others. My birth location is considered classified. I am not currently enrolled in Lander University, so I lack a major. And my interesting fact is that I collect bottle caps from sodas all over the world.
They still make soda in bottles? Nick asked skeptically.
Yes, they do, in other countries as well as in America, Mr. Transport answered, grateful to have anyone say anything. Why don't you pick up the ball and tell us about yourself now?
Mr. Transport had something that almost seemed like conversation momentum, and he would be damned if he was going to lose it.
No prob, said Nick, standing from the couch. Nick Campbell, and I've got the power of creating and controlling luck. I'm from Sin City itself, good old Vegas. I'm majoring in business while at Lander. My interesting fact is that I've been punched in the mouth by a senator.
With that, Nick plopped back down on the sofa and threw out a big, broad smile.
Punched by a senator? Would you care to elaborate on that story, Mr. Campbell?
Mr. Transport asked.
You're not the only one with shit that's classified, Nick answered.
Okay, then, Mr. Transport said quickly. Who would like to go next?
Before the word next was fully out of his mouth, the blonde girl sitting directly opposite him and Mr. Numbers had popped up from her chair like there was a spring loaded in it. He hadn't yet had the pleasure of meeting this young lady, but by process of elimination, he knew who she was before she began to speak. "My name is Alice Adair, and I have the power of flight. I'm from Los Angeles, California. While at Lander, I will be enrolled in the communications program. An interesting fact about me is that I have been riding horses since I was 5 and have won several championships,"
Alice said with a firm tone and a confident aura. She was a bit agitated that the sunglasses boy, or Nick, as it were, had beaten her to being the first to speak, but she kept that annoyance off of her face as she returned to her seat and smiled placidly.
"Very nice to meet you, Alice," said Mr. Transport. "Who wants to go next?"
He braced, waiting for another student to pop up, but it became all too apparent he had already worked his way through the confident public speakers in the group. Well, no matter. Mr. Transport knew the default solution for problems like this.
"Well, since no one wants to volunteer anymore, how about we just start at this end of the room?"
he said, pointing to Herschel. "And we'll work our way down." There were some mumbling and dissatisfied tones, but slowly, Herschel rose to his feet. The boy looked a bit better than when Mr. Transport had last seen him. The months of therapy and procedures had shrunken him from round to a wide husky, though the confidence of an elf lord about to siege a castle was strangely gone from his eyes and body language. Now that Mr. Transport thought about it, Herschel and that small girl, Mary, were the only two who hadn't spoken a word since he and Mr. Numbers appeared in the room.
"My name is Herschel Daniels, and I'm from Chicago. I'm majoring in creative writing, and an interesting fact about me is, well, I won a couple of writing competitions for my fantasy short stories,"
Herschel said in soft tones. He moved to sit down, but Nick stopped him.
"You forgot to tell us what your power is," Nick pointed out.
"Oh,"
Herschel said.
Well, I guess that's because I don't really have any powers. I mean, I do, but it's complicated."
"How complicated can it be?" Nick kept pressing. "You can either do something superhuman or you can't."
"Well, it's more that I do something, and then I can do something super. Does that make sense?"
Herschel asked timidly.
"He's a shifter,"
Mary said from her chair on the end.
"Oh, why didn't you say so? So you turn into some other form that has the powers, right?"
Nick asked.
"Yes,"
Herschel said, nodding emphatically.
"That's how it works."
"No shame in that," Nick said reassuringly. "Some of the best heroes on the record books had to go through a transformation before they were ready for business. It makes keeping your secret identity and hero identity separate all the easier, too."
"I guess it does,"
Herschel agreed, looking thoughtful about the benefit Nick had brought up. He sat down in his chair successfully at last, the burden of speech passed off of him and on to the next poor sap. Since the person to Herschel's right was Nick, who had already gone, the turn skipped to Vince. It wasn't really that Vince was scared to talk in public. It was just that everything in him was ingrained to go against the idea of volunteering. In his world, volunteering drew attention, and attention made people notice he was different. Once people noticed that, well, things always had a tendency to get far too interesting for Vince's tastes. Vince rose to his feet and addressed the room.
"My name is Vince Reynolds. My power is the absorption, storage, and redistribution of energy. I'm from New York, originally. I'm enrolled as undecided as far as my major goes. My interesting fact is that I've been in 40 of our 50 states."
Vince sat back down on the couch, quietly.
"I have to ask, how do you get your hair that color?"
Alice said, once Vince had hit the couch. She didn't really care about who his stylist was, but she was curious. The strong tone and voice that had come from Vince didn't match up with the skittish body language she had seen all night. She wanted to hear more from him to try and reconcile that personality discrepancy. "I don't," Vince said, this time a bit sheepishly. "My hair is naturally this color, and for some reason I can't get dye to stick to it."
"Oh," Alice said. "I'm sorry, I didn't know."
That was unfortunate. She had been planning on getting a full course of dialogue from him, but if it was natural and a feature he was clearly embarrassed about, then there was no way for her to press onward from her present position. "Don't worry about it," Vince said quickly. "Nick more or less asked the same thing when he first met me. It's good that people think I diet this way. It makes it easier to blend in as a human."
"Very positive attitude, Vince," Mr. Transport said. "Now then, shall we hear from our last student?"
All eyes turned to the short, wiry girl, who had thus far only spoken once, on Herschel's behalf at that, in the course of the night. Unlike the others, Mary didn't stand. She delivered her introduction from a cross-legged, sitting position in her chair.
"My name is Mary," she began, "and my power is an advanced brain which gives me telekinesis and telepathy. I was born in Louisiana, but I've been in the forests of Colorado for about 8 years now. I'm double majoring in psychology and biology, and an interesting fact about me is that I know how to turn beavers into hats."
"What's your last name?"
Herschel asked. Mary blinked several times, then let her gaze move around the room. She unconsciously let her hands pet the head of the stuffed bear in the lap. A few seconds of silence passed, and Mary looked back at her fellow dormmates.
"I don't really remember. Like I told Alice, I haven't had any need for names in a very long time,"
Mary said.
"Thankfully, we had ample need," Mr. Numbers interjected. "Your last name is Smith. You may check the releases your parents signed if you need confirmation."
"I have no reason to doubt you,"
Mary said graciously.
"Thank you, Mary," Mr. Transport said. "Tell me, does your bear have a name?"
He was fairly certain girls who were Mary's age didn't name their stuffed animals, but then his understanding was that 18-year-olds didn't normally keep their stuffed animals with them out in the open anyway, so he'd opted to ask in the hopes of seeming friendly.
"No,"
Mary said bluntly.
"I see. That was a silly question," Mr. Transport said hurriedly.
"Why do you think that?"
Mary asked him.
"Well, because you're obviously old enough that you wouldn't be naming your bear,"
Mr. Transport said.
"You misunderstand,"
Mary told him.
"I did name my bear. His name is No."
"Huh," said Mr. Transport. "Why did you name him No?"
"Why not name him No?"
Mary responded.
"Yes, well..."
Mr. Transport paused and resisted the urge to press his fingers to his temples. He didn't need the children seeing that he could be annoyed, gotten to, or given a headache. It was best to just get things back to business.
"Since Mr. Numbers already introduced himself, that takes care of the meeting agenda for tonight. But there's one last thing before Mr. Numbers and I retire. As you were all told, classes for Lander take place on the ground level, while classes for the Hero Certification Program take place in a special underground campus. Now, other dorms that house supers have special elevators to convey their students between campuses. However, since ours is new and it is not yet hooked up to the network, I will be your method of travel between these two schools.
Why couldn't we just get clearance to use an elevator at a nearby dorm? Nick asked.
Too much paperwork, Mr. Transport said, with what he hoped was a believable grin. No, in reality, it is simply that getting approval takes months and months. And since we weren't sure if any of you would be able to attend this year, we were unable to secure that approval in time. Fear not, though, for I know all of your class schedules, and I will always be around to teleport you as needed.
How do we get back up? Nick said, asking yet another question.
You can call for me on my phone, or you can ride the elevator. Getting up doesn't require clearance, only going down. Now, I'm sure you all know there is a meeting welcoming you all tomorrow at 8 in the morning, so I expect to see each of you here ready to go promptly at 7:45. Aside from that, please intermingle, get to know one another, and have a great night.
Mr. Transport gently kicked Mr. Numbers, who said something that might or might not have resembled good night, depending on the language one was using, as well as the level of sarcasm tolerated, before the meaning of a word was reversed. With a nod and a smile, Mr. Transport vanished, presumably taking Mr. Numbers with him, since the chair Mr. Numbers had occupied now sat empty. The students were overtaken with surprise at their disappearance, though this time the spectacle wore off much more quickly. The vanishing administrators left behind a vacuum in conversation, rendering the five gifted individuals with no idea what to say to one another. This vacuum was broken quickly by Nick, whose powers evidently included a need for attention and an utter lack of social insecurity.
Okay, Nick said. I'm now officially taking bets. Gay couple, or just a pair of best friends who secretly wish they were a gay couple?
9. The first thing Nick did, once he had secured his door tightly shut behind him, was to shed those idiotic sunglasses. He blinked several times as his eyes readjusted, then strolled over to his desk and turned on his computer. He opened a word processing program and immediately began writing down the day's events with as much detail as he could remember. It was a very minor challenge for him. There had been times before he had gained control of his power when he would go weeks between note-taking sessions, and he had still managed to glean information from those. Nick made no motion to save his file as he typed. He had procured a surge protector that doubled as a battery in case of a power outage, so he was relatively certain nothing would interrupt his process or destroy his work thus far. It was probably redundant in a place like this, with safeguards on top of the safeguards. But Nick hadn't survived 18 years of bipolar luck without learning to be a little redundant in his safety measures. It took him only a few minutes to finish. Nick had shockingly quick hands. And then he leaned back in his chair and began reviewing the day's events. He had done quite well, and had adhered to the primary tenets of survival in a new area. Speak much, say little, and see all. The glasses had been a good addition. He needed to thank Miss Pipps for that suggestion next time he was in Vegas. They kept anyone from reading what was on his face effectively, and they made him look like something of a jackass. That suited Nick's needs just fine. People overlooked and underestimated those they thought of as stupid, which was precisely what he wanted. Nick was a boy who could affect the outcomes of dice throws, in a school for people who could lift cars and eat fire. He was going to need every advantage he could get, and surprise was an excellent one to have. Nick continued scrolling down, rereading his recent notes. He had befriended Vince easily enough, and Herschel was socially ignorant, so getting on his good side had only required minor encouragement.
Mary was a lost cause. Nick needed a telepath hanging around him like he needed a bullet to the head. Alice, on the other hand, was a whole different story. She had some skill in reading people, but her subtlety and manipulation skills were amateurish at best. The way her eyes had been darting about during the meeting, how she'd tilted her head when she was trying to figure out a new aspect to someone, the clumsy way she had tried to lead a conversation with Vince. All of those had been tells of a novice. Nick estimated he could get her to trust him within the span of a month. After all, there were few things as vulnerable as someone with just a little bit of knowledge. The two agents he had babysitting him were going to be simple to get around. They had run a classic good cop, bad cop routine to categorize their interactions with the students. As long as he created some personal problems to ask Mr. Transport for help with, and let Mr. Numbers yell at him occasionally for minor discipline issues, neither one would think to wonder what was going on behind those sunglasses. Nick finished reading his notes, then went through them twice more. After the final pass, Nick deleted every word he had written and closed the file without saving, making sure to purge the autosave function as he did so. That done, he undressed and got into bed. He would plan for how to handle the next day for only an hour, then allow himself to get some sleep. He needed to be in top form when he met the other students, after all. Mr. Transport and Mr. Numbers sat at the dining table in their new apartment. It was a spacious two-bedroom that existed behind the door in the kitchen. They would, of course, be sharing the cooking area with the children, but since the kids had meal plans and little practical experience in taking care of themselves, neither Mr. Transport nor Mr. Numbers anticipated battling with them for space on the stove. They had also been provided with their own mini-fridge, which Mr. Numbers took as a negative sign, indicating some higher-up was aware of Mr. Transport's penchant for beer and liquor. Still, the fridge was there, so Mr. Transport had put his beer and a bottle of gin in it as they unpacked. Now the two sat, still clad in their suits, going over their assignment folders one last time before the mandatory destruction of them.
"Do you think it went well?" Mr. Transport asked from his seat.
"Exceedingly," Mr. Numbers said. "We made them perceive us in the way they were supposed to. The only exception, of course, is the telepath."
"She shouldn't pose a problem for us, though," Mr. Transport said. "Remember your training. Telepaths can only read what is going through your mind at that moment. Just be careful, and remember to control your thoughts around her."
"I'm aware of the necessary techniques," Mr. Numbers said with a slight edge to his voice. "I'm just not certain it holds true with that one. There's something about her. Something different. I worry she might be able to go deeper than most telepaths."
"I'm sure the doctors or nurses would have made note of it in the file. Besides, why would a telepath who has spent her life without control of her ability be more adept with it than those who have honed it through a lifetime of practice?" Mr. Transport asked. Mr. Numbers let out a small sigh.
"I suppose you're right. Still, we'll have to stay on our toes around her. Heaven knows we have secrets we can't afford to let some 18-year-old girl in on."
"I thought she was 17, said Mr. Transport.
"She was when we met her, but she had her birthday while she was undergoing treatment," said Mr. Numbers.
"Oh, I do hope they did some sort of celebration for her," said Mr. Transport.
"It is my understanding that there was cake," assured Mr. Numbers.
"Very good, then," said Mr. Transport. "Well, I'm ready when you are."
"Let's get the lighter and the bucket,"
said Mr. Numbers. Alice tossed and turned sleeplessly in her bed. A telepath. What had her father been thinking, allowing a telepath to be her dorm mate? He knew how much she valued her privacy. At least, she had thought he knew. What was she going to do? That Mary girl could be listening to her at that very moment. She would never know a moment's peace, never know a good sleep again. Alice had always been excellent at reading others, a skill she had first learned from watching her daddy interact with other people. Now she was stuck with a dorm mate who had been living in the damn forest for the last few years, and who was a mind reader to boot. All of Mary's social habits had been scrubbed clean by the wilderness and the solitude, so Alice had no idea what was going on in her head. On top of that, Mary could see Alice's thoughts plain as day. Never had the tables been turned on Alice like this. Never had she felt so exposed, so vulnerable. Her only consolation was that the others would be simple to deal with. Herschel was a big, insecure geek. Nick was a tongue-wagging idiot, and Vince was uncomfortable with his own uniqueness. They had all shown weaknesses to capitalize on for her own gain, so she was comfortable with them. As for the agents, Alice barely spared a thought for them. They worked for Daddy, because whether they knew it or not, everyone worked for Daddy in some way. She would be polite, and if they crossed her, she would handle them. No, there was no problem with anyone else. Alice flipped over in her bed for the thousandth time, trying to figure out how to handle Mary. Herschel was also thinking about Mary, though he and Alice had very different problems with the girl.
"She was so pretty,"
Herschel said to no one. He used to have friends, back before Roy had begun popping up more frequently, and had even managed to hang on to some personal connections through his LARP group. Those were gone now, back in Chicago, while he lay in bed alone. He desperately wished he still had them, so he could tell them about his day, about how he had gotten Roy under control, and about the beautiful girl with the amber-colored eyes he had met on his first day at college. Herschel could do none of those, though, so instead, he was talking to an empty room. He wished he could have talked to her after the meeting was over, but she went back to the girl's side almost as soon as the two administrators were gone. Did she know he was going to talk to her, and that's why she ran? A wave of insecurity washed over Herschel, one that he was more than accustomed to. Herschel was pudgy, shy, and unremarkable. He had spent his whole life feeling those waves of insecurity crash against him. The only times they weren't there was when he was dressed up in costume pretending to be someone else. Then he was brave, strong, and confident. Then he was someone worth being. Herschel felt something stir in his mind. He realized he had been calling out to Roy without noticing. That seemed to happen at his lowest points, when he wanted to be anyone else in the world besides Herschel Daniels. If not for the treatment, Roy would probably have appeared already. Fortunately, that was no longer the case. Herschel could call to him all night, but until he used the trigger that had been created, Roy would stay nothing more than a tickle in the back of his head. Still, it was hard enough to get to sleep alone. Herschel didn't want to try and pass out with both of them stirring, so he decided to think of something besides Mary and how insecure she made him feel.
"She really is so pretty,"
Herschel said once more. He rolled over
and tried to visualize anything besides Mary's amber eyes. In her own room, Mary blushed.
"Yes, I think he's very sweet, no?"
she said to her bear.
"I just think he needs a little more time to acclimate to college on his own. This is a big, new environment, and if I were to be with him, I'd become nothing more than a security blanket."
The bear stared back at her from his resting place on the bed.
"Okay, you got me. I also want to see what his other side is like,"
Mary admitted.
"Besides, there are much more interesting thoughts going on right now. Don't you agree?"
No said nothing.
"So many people thinking of little old me,"
said Mary.
"I feel like this is going to be a very interesting year."
No still said nothing.
"Oh, you rascal,"
Mary laughed.
"Maybe after a few weeks. Right now, we need to get to bed. It's going to be very loud tomorrow unless we're rested and in control."
Mary scooped Noah up and got under the covers with him. Like turning off a light switch, Mary banished away the voices in her head.
And just like that,
it was as though she were back in the forest, communing with the quiet. The ability to have silence on demand. That was something she would never grow tired of. Vince was asleep. Unlike the others, he hadn't had any large revelations about his roommates, or sudden fears about the day to grapple with. Vince had merely come in, undressed, and gotten into bed. Of course, before he slept, Vince had tenderly removed a gold pocket watch from his backpack and gently wound it as he did every night. He then checked the time and made sure the watch was running right before he set it down in a place of honor on his bedside table. Then he had gotten into bed himself, pausing on his direct flight toward the land of slumber only long enough to run a finger along the watch and softly whisper, "Good night, Father." After that, he was gone into a dream that seemed to feature fire more heavily than the ones he had regularly. 10.
"Welcome, freshmen!"
The speaker was a tall man with glasses, black hair, and a charcoal-colored suit. He cut an impressive figure, even from behind his podium, looking around the room, emanating confidence and ease, as though he had made this speech dozens of times before. Which, coincidentally, he had.
"It is my pleasure, as Dean of the Hero Certification Program, to be the first to congratulate you on making the cut and being enrolled in our very elite little academy,"
the dean continued.
"My full name is Blaine Jeffries. However, I want you all to just call me Dean Blaine. It is my hope that each and every one of you grow stronger in the years ahead, and that the best of you graduate from here with full certifications and go on to become acclaimed heroes. I want to watch all of you find the lessons you need to succeed."
"Of course he does,"
Nick muttered to Vince quietly from his seat in the middle of the auditorium.
"The more prestige a hero has, the better it looks on the school that trained them. I didn't think the 5 universities that ran this program were in competition,"
Vince said curiously.
"Where there is money, there is competition. And these bad boys are government-funded,"
Nick replied.
"Now I know all of you are a little nervous," Dean Blaine said in an understanding voice. "After all, most of you are from schools, if not towns, where you were the only super present. Having peers around you who can understand and relate to what you're going through is a new experience, and I'm here to tell you that it will be a wonderful one.
You're going to have friendships, support, and respect, all built on the mutual understanding that only fellow supers can share.
Is being a super hard? Vince whispered to Nick. I knew a few of them, and by comparison to everyone else, it seemed like they had it pretty easy.
Vince chastised himself.